Thank you very much, Paul, for your introduction, and I thank the board and the trustees of CEDA for the invitation to join you for your annual dinner. This is the fifth time, in fact, that I've had this pleasure, and it continues a long tradition. Given that it is the fifth time, I'm going to be updating some of the presentation material that I have shown you on past occasions in the hope that you might find that of interest. The first time I addressed this gathering was in 2006, and we talked about the role of finance in promoting economic development. An important part of that story was that through history, financial development and innovation went hand in hand with the extraordinary growth in living standards that was experienced as a result of the Industrial Revolution. Another part of that story was that financial development didn't come without risk. And on some occasions in history, those risks materialised in damaging or even devastating fashion. Now, back in 2006, we were talking about, among other things, the rise in debt among Australian households and the various risks that might accompany that. As it turns out, we'd had a so-called stress test on the banking system as part of the IMF's annual visit to us, and the results of that had in fact been pretty good. We weren't quite sure just how reassured we ought to be by such good results, of course. And we talked at that time in 2006 about an increase in risk-taking in certain parts of the corporate sector that was starting to grow, very active in private equity and so on at that time. And we wondered how all of that would turn out. Well, we didn't have long to wait to find the answers to questions like that. The next time I came to CEDA, 2 years later, in 2008, the GFC, so-called, had erupted, and the global economy and the financial system globally were facing their darkest moments since the 1930s. In fact, we've just had the G20 here, as you've seen. The G20 leaders had that year, November 2008, just met for the first time in Washington and taken the first steps towards putting the global financial system back onto an even keel. By that stage, growth in Australia had begun to moderate, but we feared that a much more significant slowing could be in prospect. Confidence was shaken, and understandably, households and businesses became much more cautious about spending, about taking on debt, or investing in new processes or new ideas. The deteriorating global outlook also led to large declines in asset prices globally and the prices of commodities relevant to Australia. And the feeling at that time was that our terms of trade, which had risen quite a bit in the preceding few years, had probably peaked. The fall in the terms of trade we expected to see was thought likely to subtract quite markedly from growth in national income over the years ahead. Well, it's a matter of record that due to a combination of factors, our economy and its financial system came through that real-life stress test remarkably well, all things considered. And as it turned out, our terms of trade had further, in fact a lot further, to rise. If I can get this to run, which I can't, maybe somebody can give us the first slide if that's possible. Thank you. So when I came in 2010, 2 years after the GFC had hit, it was time to introduce this chart, which I'm going to update progressively this evening. It's been a feature of my presentations here subsequently, and it will be again. At that time, the terms of trade had just broken through the peak of the preceding the 2 years earlier, and on a five-year average basis, in fact, we're at their highest level since Federation. Our assumption was they probably already peaked in 2010 and would decline steadily over the next few years. Well, updating the chart 2 years later, that assumption proved to be somewhat pessimistic. The terms of trade, in fact, peaked a year later than we thought, and about 12% higher than we thought in September of 2011. By now, I'm sorry, that was the first one, and that was the second one where they'd risen, and we then moved to putting an 11-year moving average on the chart, and the point of that was to emphasise how persistent this episode is. We've never assumed this was going to be permanent, but if there's an event big enough and persistent enough that a 10-year average of your terms of trade is 50 or 60% higher than the century trend, well, that's a big deal. Anyhow, by that stage, the terms of trade had peaked and started to come down. And it was an assumption on our part that that would continue, that the terms of trade would keep falling. And so they have. This is where we are now. In the latest version, they've fallen by about 13% since I was here 2 years ago, and about 22% since their peak, though as you can see, they remain a long way higher, a long way above the long-run historical average. As additional supply of commodities comes onto the global market, a lot of that from our own country, and as demand is now growing and presumably will keep growing more slowly than it was hitherto, our best guess would be that the terms of trade will probably fall some more over the period ahead. Even if they do fall quite a bit, that 10 or 11 year moving average will still have been quite high for quite some time. So it's been a very big episode. And just as importantly, and as this history I've given you amply demonstrates, any of these forecasts have a wide range of uncertainty. This, in fact, is something that the Reserve Bank has emphasised quite a lot in the past couple of years. We've put much more emphasis on ranges in our forecasts and estimates of how much uncertainty there is around any economic forecast, and that range of uncertainty is quite substantial. Well, the increase in the terms of trade prompted a surge in investment to supply these commodities, which now commanded higher prices. And this surge in capital spending by the resources sector has been a pretty big deal. Typically, resource investments around 2% of GDP or 3% in a big year. 2 years ago, we forecast that it was going to peak at about 8%. In fact, it's peaked just a little less than that, and it's now on the way down, and there's some observations after the vertical line there that show, roughly speaking, what we think will happen from here on in. Resource capex has fallen to about 7% of GDP now, and as this shows, and this is based on quite a lot of detailed liaison work that we do with the mining companies, which has proven to be invaluable and reasonably accurate over time, there's substantial falls ahead. Even with those falls, there are still some quite large projects in the gas sector that will hold overall resource sector investment at levels which, even at the end of the chart, are still quite high by the standards of any history up until the past few years. Well, as the expansionary effects of that surge tails off and indeed is reversed, even if partly, of course, other sources of demand in the economy need to play a stronger role in driving growth. Now, it's very clear that one of those sources of growth is growth in resource exports, which is using the capacity that this investment has in fact put in place. If you take iron ore, roughly speaking, we are nearly finished now in the process of increasing capacity from 1 million tonnes a day to 2 million. And that's being extracted and shipped. And so resource export volumes are growing very quickly, and indeed the contribution of net exports, so-called, to GDP growth in the past couple of years has been very strong, the strongest for about a decade or so. Even so, even with that, we still need stronger growth than we have had in the part of the economy that's outside the resources sector. Now, we're getting some of this. This is a chart that shows GDP growth and an estimate of so-called non-mining activity, where we attempt to strip out the resource sector and look at what's left. Now, this comes with a caution and a caveat that this is hard to do. It's an estimate. One can't claim that these are terribly precise. It's as good as you can do, but it does come with that caveat. That said, the orange line is starting to pick up, and it's grown over the past year or so at its fastest pace since about 2008. So that's good, but it would be good to see more strength here in the future as that decline in mining sector capital spending continues. There are sufficient spare labour resources that we could probably enjoy a couple of years of non-mining output growth being above its trend pace before we needed to worry too much about serious inflation pressure. Now, the non-resource sector in the traded part of the economy, the external facing part of the economy, could contribute to that, and I think should contribute to it. The decline in the exchange rate that we've had will be helpful in contributing to that, but the currency does remain above most estimates of its long-run fundamental value, particularly given the further decline in commodity prices that we've seen over this year. An exchange rate that was more in line with fundamentals would be a helpful contributor to achieving the sorts of balanced growth outcomes that we need. Turning then to domestic sources of demand and away from the resource sector and the export sector, an obvious contributor, and we're all aware of this, is the set of forces at work in the housing sector. Investment in new dwellings is rising quite strongly. Now, I think it ought to be possible, if we're sensible with demand management and sensible on the supply side, for this to go further yet, and more importantly, for this higher level of activity to stay high for longer than we've typically seen in the past. A high level of construction in housing maintained for a longer period of time, I think, is vastly preferable to a sharp boom and then bust. That alternative outcome, the boom and bust, would probably give us a higher peak in the near term, but most likely then a slump in this form of activity while mining investment was still falling. So I don't think that would be helpful. A sustained period of strong construction, on the other hand, would be more helpful from the point of view of encouraging growth in non-mining activity, and surely also from the wider perspective of housing our growing population in an affordable way. Considerations such as these are among the reasons that we ought to take a close interest in developments in dwelling prices, the flow of credit for that purpose, for housing purchase, and the prudence with which such funds are advanced. Given that this has been topical lately, it's probably opportune for me to offer tonight a few observations on this topic before I proceed with the rest of the presentation. Having fallen in late 2010 and early 2011, dwelling prices have since risen. Nationally, the median price across the country is up by about $100,000 in that time, or about 18% since the low point. Prices have risen in all capital cities, though with a fair degree of variation. The smallest increase has been in Canberra at about 6%, the largest in Sydney at 28%. Credit outstanding to households, something that we look at very carefully, is rising at about 6 to 7% a year. Now, I personally don't think that per se is a matter of concern. When we turn to the rate of growth of credit to investors, and I don't mean here property developers, I mean individuals who are borrowing for the purpose of investing in a housing asset, we see that that's picked up to about 10% a year over the past 6 months. And investors now account for nearly half of the flow of new housing credit. It's not clear whether this acceleration will continue or abate. It isn't clear whether the pace of price increases for dwellings will continue or abate. And it's not to be assumed that investor activity per se is problematic. Indeed, a fair proportion of investor transactions are involved in putting new housing stock onto the market. And that's good. We need that. It can also be observed, I think, that a bit more of the animal spirits that are evident in the housing market would be welcome in some other sectors of the economy. Nor, let me be clear, have we seen these dynamics so far, at least, as a threat imminently to financial stability, and indeed that should be clear from our recent publication on that. So we don't just assume this is a terrible problem. But by the same token, given everything we've seen around the world in the past 7 or 8 years in housing, it's surely imprudent not at least to question the comfortable assumption that this is all entirely benign. A situation where prices have already risen considerably in our two largest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, where something like a third of our people live, where prices are rising at present considerably faster than incomes, and where an important area of credit growth has picked up to double-digit rates, ought to prompt the reasonable observer to ask the question whether just a few people might maybe be starting to get just a little overexcited. Such an observer might want to satisfy themselves that lending standards are being maintained, and they might contemplate whether perhaps some suitably calibrated and focused action to help ensure sound standards, and that might perhaps lean into the price dynamic to some extent, might be appropriate. So that's the background to the very much publicised single sentence in our recent financial stability review to the effect that the bank was working with other agencies to see what more might be done to reinforce sound lending standards. Let me be clear what this is not about, okay? It's not an attempt to restrain construction activity. On the contrary, this is an attempt to be as sure as we can be that we elongate the upswing in housing construction. Nor is it a return to widespread attempts to restrict lending via direct controls. I'm old enough to remember that era very well, and that was one in which the price of credit overall was simply too low. Credit growth to just about everybody was too fast, and we were trying and failing to restrain that credit growth by the resort to regulatory tools instead of raising its price. That didn't make sense. But that isn't the problem we have today. We don't have the problem that interest rates are too low across the board. And the fact that credit growth generally is fairly moderate testifies to that fact. The level of interest rates is very low, but that's well warranted on macroeconomic grounds. The economy has spare capacity. Inflation's well under control, and that looks quite likely to be the case over the next couple of years. In such circumstances, monetary policy ought to be accommodative, and it is, and on present indications is likely to be that way for some time yet. But for accommodative monetary policy to do the best thing for the whole economy, it's helpful if pockets of potential overexuberance don't get too carried away in the process. Let me turn then from housing investment to investment more generally, that is by businesses, and here a more robust picture for capital spending outside of mining would certainly be part of a further strengthening of growth over time. Some of the key, in fact, a number of the key ingredients for that are in place. To date, there are some promising signs here of stronger intentions, but not so much yet in the way of actual commitments by businesses. That's often the way it is at this point of the cycle. Firms wait for the time when they feel more confident. They wait to see whether there's more evidence of stronger demand. And of course, part of the stronger demand when it comes is going to come from them. It's somewhat circular, but that is actually how the economy works. So that's an area where we need to watch this space. With respect to consumer demand, I need to complete the picture by showing an update of another chart from last time. This is household saving rate and the ratio of debt to income on the right-hand side. Not a lot has changed here. If we update this, that's what's happened, so not a huge amount. Debt is rising just a little faster than income right now because income growth is quite slow because of the falling terms of trade. The saving rates come down a little bit. That's not that surprising. Household consumption growth has picked up a little bit. I'd describe it as moderate. And given that interest rates are low, that asset values and wealth have risen, a slight decline in the rate of saving is not that surprising, and indeed we think it may decline a little further in the period ahead. The thing I think we shouldn't expect, and I've said this many times before, is we shouldn't expect a period where household consumption persistently grows considerably faster than income year after year, and the saving rate behaves the way it did from the mid-80s there through to about 2005. I very much doubt that that will happen again. I don't think it should happen again, and the reason for that is that the debt load there is already quite high, and it's probably not prudent for that to go up a long way from where we are. So that's what I have to say about sources of demand, and none of that is terribly new. The other thing I'd like to come back to then is some remarks I made last time about productivity. At that stage, there was some evidence, very, very tentative evidence, that productivity was starting to improve. So here is the level of labour productivity. We take out mining and utilities because the very unusual things have happened in those two sectors. So this is the rest of the market part of the economy. The level through time and some trend rates of growth. And you can see that 93.4 to 03.04 was a stellar period. That was a remarkably good period for productivity growth in Australia, and then things slowed down quite materially after that. 2 years ago, I pointed to that uptick in the red line and said, well, that's a promising sign, but let's see what happens. That's what's happened if we extend the trend and extend the actual data. So it's becoming clearer, I think, that labour productivity as measured this way is on an improving track now. The standard caveats apply. It's hard to measure productivity. This is not multi-factor productivity, which is even harder to measure. It's the simpler concept of labour productivity. But to me, at least there's some evidence that's consistent with the hypothesis that things are getting onto a better track. We shouldn't find that surprising. Business models right around the country have been challenged by the substantial change occurring in the economy. That change itself is a response to changes in relative prices, in technology, in the exchange rate, and so on. The good news is that businesses can respond to that, and they have been doing so. That's the good side of that story. That process will need to continue. There'll be no let up. And you will recall that there is the so-called to-do list that we've talked about on other occasions as set out by the Productivity Commission. So this is good news, and those remaining challenges remain for us and will in the period ahead. What I'd like to do, though, is to now in the remaining time is to pose a slightly related but different set of questions. I think these questions are increasingly being asked, and it's about whether our overall business environment is conducive enough to risk-taking and innovation, and whether we're doing enough to develop the relevant competencies and capabilities for the modern world. These questions might involve or might include ones like, how easy is it to start a business? if the business fails, as many do, particularly small ones, is it easy enough to try again? How easy is it to hire employees? And I know I'll get in trouble for saying this, but how easy is it also to let the employees go if things don't work out? Because if it's too hard to let them go, then it's too hard to hire them to begin with. Are the rewards of a scientific and research career sufficient to attract a share of our best and brightest? Or are they all going into designing financial products? What's the role of private sector support for research and development, as distinct from our rather heavy reliance historically on government support? Is business itself doing enough here? Does industry want to get more involved in R&D? Does academia want to let it? Can private finance, be that banks or venture capital, angel investors, private equity, whoever, can they get more involved in supporting innovation? Are the entrepreneurs who'd like to receive that support prepared to accept the discipline that comes with it? These and other questions, this is a much broader discussion than the competitiveness conversations we typically have, as important as they are. We're really coming at the question of whether we can have the competencies across multiple dimensions to be effective in the modern global economy. I don't know the answer to that because these questions, frankly, are beyond my competence to answer. I would note that others more qualified than I have given opinions on these things, and indeed CETA itself has done some interesting work that's relevant to a number of these questions. So I'd refer you to those documents. So this is very hard. The thing I'd like to do, though, is to give a positive commentary about Australian competence in one thing that I've myself observed fairly closely over the past year. You might have noticed we've just hosted the G20. This is quite a big deal. Here was something global, complex, requiring careful leadership. We last hosted G20 in 2006 in Melbourne, and I was at that meeting. In fact, I'm one of the few governors still around who was at that ministers and governors meeting at the time. Since then, the scale and complexity of the G20 have grown almost beyond recognition. In those days, the leaders didn't meet. Now they meet every year. There are a host of ministerial and other meetings at various levels, something like 60 formal meetings a year under the auspices of the G20. There's the B20, the C20, the L20, the Think20, the Youth20, various other groups. All of these have their own legitimate reason for being. They all have their own agenda. Somehow we have to make those agendas fit with the main G20 agenda. And that main G20 agenda itself seriously needed refining, focusing, and streamlining this year. The G20 needed to show that it could effectively meet the challenge of securing better economic performance, or to use the language that the G20 has been using, to foster strong, sustainable, and balanced growth. Australia, meanwhile, is one of the smallest members of this group by GDP and certainly by population. We can't match the scale of human resources available to the larger countries on every single work stream that's in the G20. We're geographically remote. It's costly in money and time for people to come here. We're not powerful enough simply to demand that they follow our lead or to command their attention. And it was our job to manage this rather unwieldy body effectively in 2014. Well, I wasn't at the meetings in Brisbane, but I've been at a number of the other meetings during the year. And the feedback that I've received from my counterparts is uniformly and universally positive, strongly so. They judge that the Australian presidency has, by the metrics that count, been very successful. Prodigious efforts by exceptionally dedicated people in the public and private sectors have ensured improvements to the agenda, to process, to logistics, to the conduct of meetings, and to the outcomes of the G20. Substantive things have been achieved in the form of pro-growth commitments that, if they're carried through by the various jurisdictions around the world, will make a material difference to well-being of citizens in G20 countries. Achieving all that was costly in human and financial resources. It required coordination between multiple organisations. It wasn't on the scale of running the Olympics, something that Australia also did well, but it nonetheless has been a big deal and it's been done well. It wasn't achieved by effortless superiority. Rather, it owed to careful preparation, astute use of some of our natural advantages, and continuous effort over a long period. But that's where success always comes from, right? The only question is how badly we want it. Responsibility for the G20 now passes to Turkey. We can bask in the glow of success for a couple of weeks and then get on to other matters. But the point simply is, this has gone well. This is a thing that Australians have done well on a global stage. And it's the result of the determined efforts of a range of people who were clear about what they wanted to achieve and who mobilised the necessary resources and effort to get there. I might note in passing one other result of our leadership of the G20, and this is very much our treasurer's doing, is that the issue of infrastructure is well and truly on the table. Nobody doubts the need for infrastructure provision, not just in our country, but in many. And of course, it has clear economic advantages. It supports demand while you're building it, but it also enhances the economy's supply capability for the future. So it has a short run and a long run payoff. It's also clear from the various discussions over this year that the problem isn't a shortage of capital to fund infrastructure investment. The issues to be overcome don't include finding the money. What they do include is appropriate project selection, long-term planning, governance around that whole process, appropriate contract design, appropriate risk sharing between the public and private sectors, both of whom have some risks that they're better at bearing than the other, pricing the use of the infrastructure once it's built, and so on. There's an opportunity here, including for Australia, to do something of value over the years ahead. Of course, we'll need to be serious. We'll need to put in the effort over that extended period in all these areas. If we don't put it in, not much infrastructure will be delivered. But if we are serious, a lot could be achieved. And I would imagine that the Committee for Economic Development of Australia would be keen to be involved in that process. Well, I've reached the limits of our time this evening, so let me conclude. Australia's economy is continuing to grow moderately. It's been responding in ways you would expect to the rather extraordinary set of circumstances that it's faced over the past decade. I would argue that we've met them with some success, though of course the game is not yet over. There's continuing adjustment ahead and doubtless no shortage of challenges. But beyond the challenges of the next couple of years, maximising our economic possibilities in the modern world requires sustained efforts at adaptation and innovation, at doing things better and better every day, and perhaps most of all, a willingness occasionally to take the odd risk. I'd be confident that we have, or we could develop, where needed, the relevant capabilities. The only question really is whether we're sufficiently determined to succeed in deploying them. Thank you very much for your attention.
Perhaps I'll kick off with first question and we were just talking over dinner about the phase in the market we're at where confidence is starting to be regained, particularly by business, but we still seem to be a little bit risk adverse and people are a little bit reluctant to make investment decisions. Is that something you'd normally see, and how long would you normally see that go for in a cycle like this?
I think it is pretty normal in most business cycles to have these periods where conditions are in place for stronger growth, but it takes time to emerge. My memory of previous cycles, and I've lived through a few now, is that that's often the case. And sometimes, particularly with business capital spending, we find a few years later that we look back and it actually was starting a bit earlier than we knew at the time once all the data are in, because this is a hard thing to measure. So I think qualitatively, it's perhaps not that surprising. And if you add to that the fact we did have a major international financial crisis, it didn't affect us terribly badly, but it did have some effect, and people remember that, and people are understandably, I think, more circumspect for some time after that. So you add all these things up, and you can understand it. The thing is, you know, we need to get by it. We need to get past it at some point and get to a stage where shareholders are not saying to the board, just keep giving us the dividend and give our capital back, but are saying, you know, what are you doing to invest our money for future growth? And I think that will come. I can't tell you exactly when or quite what the trigger will be, because there is no direct trigger for those things that we have. So we need to get to that point, and as I say, the timing of that is inevitably just not knowable.
We just need a first mover, somebody to get it rolling.
We do. I think a lot of boards know that someone needs to move, and they're saying, after you.
Some questions. I think we've got one over here.
Yeah, hi, Glenn.
Hello? Just identify your name and where you're from.
Warren Hill from Data 3. Thank you very much for the presentation. Very, very interesting. I was curious. The Credit Suisse came out yesterday and hit the nail on the head, I think, with the request to drop the interest rate below 2%. I think we need to get another percentage off as quickly as we can, just to get some stimulus into the marketplace. And one of the items that you didn't address, and I'd like to get your views, is the unemployment rate, which is rising far quicker than the housing rates at this point in time, and how that's affecting our economy moving forward.
The unemployment rate's been going up very gradually for probably about 18 months. That's because the economy hasn't quite turned in the output growth that we need to absorb the growth in labour force. And as we've said, it'll probably be a little while yet, I think, before we see that turn down. I think we will see it turn down, but it'll be a little while ahead before that occurs, and that's what we've been saying pretty consistently for quite a while now.
More questions? One here, down on the floor.
I'm Edward Smith from Australian Unity. Just suppose in theory you were thinking about the possibility of macro-prudential tools to rein in the housing market. What sort of shape might some of those tools take?
Well, let's remember what I said this wasn't about. It's not about reining in the housing market broadly defined. It's about making sure that the flow of credit to investors, which has picked up, continues to be lent on a prudent basis. So the tools which would be deployed by APRA when the time comes would be things that would be calibrated sensibly and in a targeted way to do that. They would be very unlikely to be some of the tools that have been mooted in public by some commentators. Loan-to-value ratio limits, for example, probably is not the tool to be used in this instance, because high LVR lending, mainly that's actually to new owner-occupiers, and they're not the problem. So you wouldn't do something that's aimed at them. It would be more something aimed at just ensuring that lending standards and capital adequacy for investor-type loans are up to scratch, and when it's time for something to be said about that, I'd expect that APRA will be saying something. But I'm not here to say it tonight.
Some other questions? At the back? Thank you.
Yeah, Rod Maddock from Cedar Board. My question is, why has the Australian dollar stayed higher for longer than the banks seem to expect, I guess most commentators expect? What's the in-house view on the currency?
The view we have, which ought to be pretty clear, is that it's on pretty much any fundamental metric that you can come up with, it's above that. Depending on which metric you choose, it's noticeably above or not that far above, and those metrics vary, but it's pretty clear which side it's on. It's, I think, the answer to why that's so, that's a very interesting question, and put 10 economists here, you'll get at least 10 answers, maybe more. But I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we live in a very unusual environment globally. We have exceptionally low rates of return in the major countries, not just on their money market rates that the central bank sets, but on all the assets they have. And the assets in this country, everything, not just the overnight rate, but the whole spectrum of financial instruments, real assets, property, commercial property, etc., all those rates of return look very attractive, even though they are, by our standards, historically they're low, and I still get plenty of mail complaining about how low. To foreigners, these yields look good. And so there's, you know, that tendency for capital to come and seek those yields. We can't change that. That's a feature of the world we live in. But the thing we have said is that, and I've said this more than once, and I'm happy to repeat it, I think investors in the foreign exchange market and international capital markets have been underestimating the likelihood of a decline in the Australian dollar over time. I think they were underestimating it, and it has declined, and I suspect there's probably further decline to come at some point in time. I just can't tell you exactly when.
Other questions over here?
Governor, thank you very much for your comments. My question is, as you know, the Americans very aggressively have used quantitative easing as an instrument of policy, certainly the extent we've seen recently the Japanese have as well, Europeans, and none of it has really produced inflation. Why have we not been as aggressive here in terms of using quantitative easing? And can you give me some of your views on this?
Well, it's certainly true that thus far the balance sheet measures or QE that the Fed and others have used haven't produced inflation. In fact, their intent was to ward off deflation or inflation being too low. Not entirely without success, it would appear. Why don't we use QE? Well, we don't need to. QE is a thing you use when interest rates get to zero, which is not a point that we've reached, not a point I think we're likely to reach. And so apart from a very brief period in the heat of the crisis when we did expand our balance sheet to provide liquidity at a time of acute tension, and that was very quickly subsided, and we reversed that. But apart from that, we haven't needed to use balance sheet measures here for the simple reason that we have a positive interest rate. It can go down if it needs to. It hasn't got to the zero bound, and it's at the zero bound where quantitative measures are really seriously under consideration.
More questions up the front end? If you could say your name and organisation too, please.
Yes, Nick Proud from the Residential Development Council, which is a division of the Property Council. Governor, the forecast for this calendar year for residential starts was around about 158,000 to 160,000 starts. As of the end of June, we were hitting 182,000 starts. So we're about 20,000 to 30,000 above the average, but 20,000 above the actual forecasts. And we have a great opportunity to leverage the strong position of the residential industry at the present point in time. And just bringing in the new CEDA Chair's position, Paul McClintock, can we use the review of Federation with tax and areas such as development assessment reform to seize the opportunity with such a strong set of conditions around such a critical part of the economy, which is construction and residential development?
I think that was a comment, but... and it wasn't actually mainly directed at me, I don't think, which is a nice change.
I don't think I could figure a question out of that one. Any other questions or comments? Over here, thank you. Again, if you could have your name and organisation, please.
Hello, my name is Guy Dixon from NINA. Governor, I'd like to raise the issue of productivity. In your opinion, are we sufficiently focused on those aspects of the economy that are showing signs of being laggards in terms of increasing productivity? The one that's of particular interest to me is utilities distribution. We see a breakout across the world at the moment of a need for rising utility prices at a time of reducing demand, which seems to be impacting on our productivity growth. Are we sufficiently focused at this point in time on productivity?
Good question. We've certainly tried to put the focus on productivity as really the only source of long-run growth in living standards. I've been talking about this for a few years, and my colleague in the Treasury, Martin Parkinson, has been a very powerful advocate of this focus as well. I think, as I said in the presentation, that the evidence is that productivity in enough sectors of the economy is starting to improve, that we're seeing some tangible signs of results in the data. So that's encouraging. Is it enough? I think this process really has to continue for quite a long time. I think that across a broad range of fronts in the economy, it isn't so much that governments can, introduce a program that boosts productivity. That's not how it works. I've said this before in this audience. The productivity actually comes from you, from business. But it comes when you're prompted and able to make the adjustments in the way you do things that produce better output per unit of labour and of capital. On the utilities issue per se, I'm not an expert in this field by any means. My understanding is that there are some regulatory issues surrounding the way pricing is done and returns on capital are computed and so on. And that's led to some probably undesirable outcomes in terms of gold plating and price rises and so on. The way to address that, presumably, is to look at the regulatory space. That's beyond my level of responsibility or expertise, but presumably that's where you'd go looking in that specific area. But more generally, productivity comes from using better technique, better ways of doing things, better equipment, more highly trained workers, and better practices and processes every day. That's where it comes from. So in other words, it comes from you. And thank you for doing it. Please keep doing it.
More questions? Over here, thank you. The microphone's coming.
Hi, Glenn. Alexis Gray from Vanguard. So the Australian economy has performed pretty well. We haven't had a recession since the early 90s. So I was just wondering what your greatest concerns are about the medium-term outlook, say the next 5 to 10 years, given that we've been performing so well for so long.
Well, I think in the next 2 or 3 years, we have to complete this transitional period as the mining capital spending tails off. That has a long way to go, and we need more balanced growth in the economy. And I've talked about that at some length this evening and in other places as well. So that's doing what we can to foster that. Let's be under no illusion that we can fine-tune this. Certainly the central bank can't, but we do what can reasonably and responsibly be done. I think part of that will involve making sure that we don't overdo the enthusiasm on housing values, as I've been talking about. There's nothing wrong with prices having gone up a bit, and it's good to see construction, but what we want here is a long, steady upswing, not a huge boom and bust, because that will set us back on the transition that we want. Beyond that, I think the issues come to basically the things I'm trying to talk about in the latter part of my address. Our general capabilities, competencies, and our confidence in ourselves to use that. You know, if we get those things roughly right, then there are many reasons to be optimistic. There'll still be a business cycle. And I think it is a mistake for us to keep telling this story of 23 years with no recession. I don't actually think it's accurate for a start. I think, but for the vagaries of quarterly national accounting, we might well have called the end of 2000 a recession, and we would have called the end of 2008 one. In fact, I would call it that. I think we had a recession then, but it was a brief one. It wasn't terribly deep, and we got out of it quickly. And the question to ask isn't how you can go another 20 years without a recession. It's how you can have small ones and get out of them quickly. What are the preconditions for that? And that's a conversation worth having. I personally think it's a mistake to keep telling us this, ourselves this myth of the 23 years, because we're bound to have a downturn at some point. I don't know when or exactly why, but it's... You know, it's very likely that at some stage that will occur, and we will need to think sensibly and in a mature fashion about that when it comes. And I think having told this story that we don't have recessions, I don't think that's actually a very good way to start that conversation. So that's a general point. But our biggest issues are, can we be competent and productive and apply those capabilities, have a bit of confidence in ourselves, and take some well-calibrated risks for prosperity? That's the question.
Question over here. Again, if you could have your name and organisation, please.
My name is Dean Rolfe. I work at PwC. Mr Stevens, I was interested in your comments around achieving more balanced growth in the economy, and particularly bearing in mind unemployment, of course, is a lagging indicator. My question goes to tax reform. It's obviously a very topical issue at the moment, but in a global economy where movement of capital is very easy, and increasingly offshoring of jobs as well, and the digitisation of the economy, I'm just curious as to your views on perhaps the state of the debate around tax reform in Australia and where you think we should head.
On the international side, of course, the G20's got this commitment to work together to try to address this issue of revenue shifting. I think that's very important. the bigger question of, in the long run, how feasible it is to tax capital in general versus the immobile factors of production and so on, that's quite a big question. I don't really want to buy into it because I'm not qualified to do so. On tax reform generally, well, there's going to be, I think, government work on this in the period ahead, so presumably these issues of the base, the kind of tax, and the rates you levy it at will all be taken account of in that work, and we should hope that that's done thoroughly and await the outcome.
I think we've got time for probably one more question over here.
Hi, Justin Trebo from ANZ. When you put your forecast together, I presume you think about the risks being pretty symmetric to the outlook. I guess my question is whether you, deep down in your gut, you think that's the case at the moment, particularly when it's very heartening to see your first chart was around the terms of trade, and we all underestimated every year, year in, year out, on the way up, how high the terms of trade went, and on the way down. So far, my guess is that most of us have underestimated how quickly they've fallen, and we've all got forecasts for a pretty benign outcome, I think, or most of us. Do you think the risk to the growth forecast, you know, which matters for monetary policy for the next couple of years, are skewed to the downside for the next couple of years, particularly around the terms of trade outlook? And also, is it your view that the currency is just a shock absorber? So the currency helps in rebalancing, but for overall growth, it's actually just helping around the edges at the moment and over the next couple of years. Thanks.
So there's two questions there. One's on the balance of risk. Well, it's in the S&P, which I know, Justin, most people here would be put to sleep by reading that section, but you, I know, are energised by reading it. So it's all there. I personally think I'm less worried by the prospect that things will be too strong than by the possibility that they'll be too weak in the period in the near term. But the risks are all set out, and you can think of upside ones as well as downside ones, and make your own view about which way they might fall. On the exchange rate being a shock absorber, well, I think it still is. We could have done with it doing a little bit more shock absorbing in the past year or two than it did do, but actually, over the broad sweep of time, I think it will still do that job. It may not always do it just on cue when we think we want it to, but then we've got to remember, and my view is, the market generally in the past 30 years, more often than not, has done a better job of setting that price than I would have done if it had been my job to try to set it. So, you know, we've got a float. We have to go with that. And occasionally it's a bit irritating or a bit concerning. It's a new phenomenon for it to be a concern that it seems a bit high. For most of my career, the concern is the other way. But there it is, and I still think, really, that over time, the flexible rate is probably going to do the job that we need it to do.
One last question.
To say again, you know, I still think there's a pretty material risk that it goes lower than where it is today.
Thanks. Glenn, Phil Graham from Mercer. You haven't spent too much time talking about the global economy tonight. You've obviously had the benefits of the G20 meeting over the weekend to talk to many interesting people about that. And just in the last little while, we've had the news from Japan about going back into recession. Back in September, October, it was concerns about Europe and Germany. We also know Russia's having its problems, Brazil not looking great. It's only the US that's really keeping things going at the global level. I just wonder if you could share any updated thoughts that you may have on the global outlook.
Well, thanks, Phil. I don't think I've got much to add really to what we published only a couple of weeks back. I think the news in Japan, I guess, was a bit weaker than the market consensus. Overall, I think we're still searching for a good sense of how well Japan's coming back after the tax increase. And I think we're going to be grappling as well with what the possible implications are of the BOJ stepping up the QE. Personally, I think this is an issue which should get more attention than it does. BOJ is going to be doing nearly as much QE as the Fed was at their peak. If we thought that what the Fed was doing was important, it must follow that what BOJ is doing is important as well. And the fact that the US is on apparently one course of monetary policy, Japan's on another, and Europe is probably also, you know, on its own track as well, which won't see interest rates rise for quite a long time at best. I think that matters for financial markets, and I suspect we'll continue to see markets grappling with what all that means over the period ahead. So there could be a bit of turbulence there. The country I don't think you mentioned was China, which really is, I think, still proceeding pretty well. It's probably going to achieve growth something like the authorities target this year, it would appear. They've already reached their annual target for employment growth already, before we've got to the end of the year. There's uncertainty around how the property side and all the debt that's built up there, how that will all work out. That's probably the key uncertainty in China, in my opinion. But so far, they've continued to turn in pretty decent growth performance, even by their standards, let alone others. So they're doing pretty well. The US, I think, is doing quite well. It's certainly true that Europe's struggling, but the environment for us is not as great as it was, but it's still quite manageable, I think, and it's up to us to manage it.